Yours is called to order. It's 9:05. It's May the 9th. And present for the record are Senators Green, French, Stevens, and myself, McGuire. We do have a quorum to conduct business. We have three items on the agenda today. SJR 9 will not be heard today. We will be hearing first Senate Bill number 162, voting by mail, then Senate Bill number 171, judicial retention candidacy withdrawal, and then House Bill number 92, jurisdiction of ombudsman victims' rights. So first up, we have Senate Bill number 162. And there is a CS, if I could have a motion to adopt it, and then we'll hear about it.
Madam Chairman, I would move, we've got CS for Senate Bill 162, version M, for consideration by the committee.
Okay, so is there an objection? Hearing and seeing none, we have M before us.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joanne Schmidt, staff to Senator Kim Elton, and he does extend his apologies for not being here this morning to introduce this bill. He is in Senate Finance this morning. So Senate SB 162, voting by mail, is an act establishing that a general election may be conducted by mail. It's an extension of what we now use with our absentee ballot system. So basically, this bill is just adding language that gives the Division of Elections, as well as voters, another option in the way that they cast their votes. There are numerous benefits in allowing voters to submit votes by mail. For instance, some voters, particularly parents with small children, seniors, the disabled, can participate in an election without having to leave their home. Voters will not have to leave work early, arrive later, make special arrangements to travel to the polls. Other states using vote by mail for general elections, such as Oregon, have reported an average 53% to 89% voter turnout, which is a dramatic increase from the national average of 23%, which is about standard for our turnout here in Alaska. A positive financial impact has been demonstrated when vote-by-mail elections are made available to voters. It is estimated that by-mail voting is one-third to one-half the cost of polling place elections, which averages $4.30 per vote by polling, as opposed to $1.23 per vote by mail, and lower administrative costs will reduce demand to hire and train poll workers.
Okay, questions? Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. I've always had problems with vote by mail because it seems like, my concern is fraudulent. The ballot goes out, anybody can pick it up, anybody can send it back. And I like the sanctity of the ballot box. It's a communal thing. People go together and meet friends and chat about things and do their civic duty rather than just saying in the quiet of their own home. So, but really the main concern is voter fraud, and you may be able to convince me, but it's going to be hard. And I'd like to hear why you think that there won't be abuse of that system.
Okay, Senator Stevens, through the chair, there are security measures in place that will be implemented if this is used in the state of Alaska. And actually, Oregon started vote by mail over 6 years ago, and they've been very, very successful. And there are certain procedures that they use with security envelopes, matching signatures. And actually, this really came about after the elections in Florida and using the computer-based election systems, which proved to be terribly fraudulent. And there was really no way of tracking the honesty of voters. And actually, this has been proven to be very, very successful and minimizes any sort of tampering at all.
Thank you.
And one more comment, yeah. Senator Stevens, to the chair. This will not in any way remove the opportunity for voters to cast their ballot at the polls.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I share some of Senator Stevens' concerns about the rituals of voting, and you get up, go to a polling place, and somehow may make more reasoned decisions than, there's a ballot laying on the kitchen table, I got to fill this out before I run off to work kind of thing. But I did want to ask a couple of questions about the sponsor statement. You said that the Oregon percentage went way up compared to the national average, but what was it compared to Oregon's average before the mail-in? I mean, you're comparing apples to oranges.
Senator Bundy, through the chair, I'm sorry, can you clarify your question?
Yeah. Oregon percentage after voter, mail-in voter went from 50, did it go from 53% to 89%? Is that how I should read this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm sorry, and I misunderstood what they were saying. All right, the other thing is you mentioned the cost. We're certainly still going to have polls, and are you suggesting we'll have fewer polls? Or is it that if we have 100 voters come in, it costs $4.30 a vote, and but if we only have 10 voters come in, we're saving money? I don't know how. We still have the same people, the same building, same process.
Senator Bundy, through the chair. First of all, I'm going to address your first question. At the beginning of the Oregon project, their voter turnout was about 23%, just like the national average. And over a five-year period of time, it slowly went up to 59% to finally, this past year, 89% turnout, which is unprecedented in our nation. Secondly, we are allowing the Division of Elections to make the determination, first of all, if they even want to institute a general election by mail, and if they choose to do so, it's up to their discretion whether or not to remove some of the polling places. But certainly this is something that is regulated federally, so you can't just arbitrarily remove a polling place, particularly in rural communities.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd point out that I believe, if my memory serves, there are some rural communities that have very high voter turnout in the 80%, so they're able to achieve that without changes, but I think that's a matter of motivation. And from what you've said then, as I understand it, the Division of Elections has not asked for this legislation.
Senator Bunny, through the chair, no, but they do not oppose it either. And I think that the real heart of this legislation is that we really need to get people involved in the democratic process, and it is almost criminal to think that out of all of the voters in our communities, only 20 to 23% even care to show up and feel that their voice is being heard. So if this will help, it's extremely important.
Madam Chair, well, in my district, it's 60-plus, but I agree. However, encourage thoughtless participation is not somewhere where I'd want to go, which I think this does. Thank you.
I have a question before, and then I'll get to Senator Prinches. How is the system right now? We were just talking about this yesterday. You can request an absentee ballot, and you can vote from your home as it stands right now. So what is the distinction that we're making? So the way I understand it right now is if you're elderly or you're going to be out of town, or even if you just feel you're going to be inconvenienced that day, you're sort of looking ahead and you can see your day is going to be busy, you can, for any reason, request an absentee ballot, and you can vote by mail. So what do you think is making the difference between going to a system like this and what we have now, which does enable voters to vote at home?
Madam Chair, the difference is that every registered voter with a valid address will be mailed a ballot rather than just by request.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, Senator French.
Thank you, and thanks for being here. I guess I'm more of a proponent of this than I thought. I've listened to some of the comments this morning. Particularly, I don't know if Senator Bundy really meant to say that there would be thoughtless participation in the voting process. Maybe that was just a...
No, I meant to say it.
Okay. Well, at least we're clear on that. We do allow absentee voting. I don't think anyone suggests that absentee votes count less than other votes because they're performed at home. I think many of us make important decisions at home with a consultation of our loved ones and our family. And the idea that going off to a ballot box is somehow a more hallowed distinction sounds like it's church, which maybe it is like church. But the experience has been that vote by mail gets more people involved in the democratic process. And I guess if you oppose that idea, if you don't like people voting, then you should try to resist any measure that would do that. I'm unaware of any single instance of voter fraud that's produced a bad result in an election driven by vote by mail. If that's out there, I'd love to see it, and I would prosecute that person and work hard to make sure that didn't happen. But people are busy, lives are busy, storms happen, and it seems to me that this is a way to get more people voting, and I just think that's the centerpiece of our democratic process. So I enthusiastically support your bill.
Okay, are you done with, I don't want any more preaching.
No, I'm not preaching.
Instituting a committee chair rule.
I might.
Okay, Senator Bundy, clearing your point.
And I think Senator French maybe unintentionally mischaracterized my position. Certainly with absentee ballots, people make an effort to be involved. I certainly want more people involved. I don't think this would achieve that goal.
Okay. Through the demagoguery, I see both your points. That said, the one concern I still do have on the fraud is real. I actually am I used to live in Oregon, saw people vote, didn't see any fraud, but there is one little thing that I just keep thinking about, and it kind of goes back to the Judicial Council and the way that the votes are cast for folks in that system and some of the things that I have observed and heard, and that is the idea of block voting. The idea that somebody would be mailed a ballot, wouldn't really be engaged, wouldn't have read the voter pamphlet, wouldn't know who, and sort of would get together with neighbors and sort of say, well, what do you think? What do you think? What do you think? That does concern me a little bit, because I do think that, as Senator Bundy has said, and Senator French, when you cast a vote, it should mean something. And I don't think it means any less voting by mail or voting in person, but I do think that very act of asking for a ballot does say something. And I'm not sure how to describe it, but there's just a little bit of a fear that I have that sits out there that the person hasn't made a concerted step. If they want to vote from home, it's real simple. You can fax in to the division a request for an absentee ballot. You could call by phone and ask for one. So that's the only other thing. And then the other thing that strikes me, I remember when I was growing up with my folks, there were many battles about cancellation of votes. And I remember as a kid listening to them talk about it, and I'm sure that's not unlike discussions in many other households. As Senator French says, many important discussions happen in the home, but there are times where I think a family member might want that ability to go inside a polling place without a family member that might be very influential casting their vote for them. And I could just envision a circumstance where there may be a pressure in a home if you had a patriarchal father or a matriarchal mother that said, everybody's going to vote by mail, and we're all going to vote around the kitchen table, and this is how we're going to vote. And I don't know, that's just one other thing to think about. So I got my demagoguery in, too. Jason Huey. And I'm going to go ahead and hold the bill over, let it simmer. You want to offer testimony?
I'll answer questions.
Okay. So Jason is here with the Division of Elections to answer questions. Senator Stevens.
Well, I think several issues have come up, Jason, and the biggest one is fraud. And as Senator French has said, maybe there's I don't know if there's been any fraudulent use of mail-in ballots in the past in Oregon or wherever. And I've used the absentee ballot if I'm traveling and out of town. But it's an effort. It's not an easy thing to do. You've got to call someone, get a ballot mailed to you, get it in time, do it, mail it off, and all that. So my concern is still fraud. And even though there may have not been cases we know of, it seems to me it'd be relatively easy if you were dishonest to, vote your parents' ballot or, someone to take advantage of the system. Is that of any concern to the department?
For the record, I'm Jason Hooley, Office of the Lieutenant Governor. And I want to say I haven't seen the CS, so I'm not sure what the differences are between that and the original bill, but the integrity of the voting process is at the top of the list of the division's concerns. And within the absentee process, there are some processes that we have implemented that address that. And I can follow up with more information to you guys, to the committee, on that from the director, Whitney Brewster. But we do share concerns that it is important to prohibit and prevent fraud in the elections process. That's paramount to the division.
Thank you, Jason.
Senator Bundy.
And the bill's sponsor makes an interesting argument, pointing out positives. I'm sure the Division Election must be aware of the Oregon system. I understand the Division doesn't oppose it, but if it's such a good idea, why didn't the Division move to this previously?
I'll try to answer that. I don't think the Division and the sponsor have talked much about this particular piece of legislation, to my knowledge. And I think the Division would request some more time to collaborate with the sponsor to further understand their intentions. And we do share the same goals, ultimately, of the importance of voter participation and engagement and increasing turnout. And I think there's some room for us to collaborate with the sponsors on that, and we haven't yet had the chance to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
And on that point, Jason, I would add too, that I would like to analyze if there are, between you and the bill sponsor, if there are places where voters have identified difficulty or complexity in the request for the absentee process, because I do think that the ability to vote in your home for some people makes the difference between voting or not. And if you don't have a ride, if you're disabled, if you don't have the ability to make it to the polls, that is infringing on your rights to vote. And so I just would be curious to know if there are places, maybe we'll bring this back up again, but maybe short of this whole change in policy, there are changes that we can make that would increase voter access by mail that haven't been considered yet. And then the only other thing I wanted to ask, are there more questions for Jason? Because I wanted to ask the bill sponsor's representative one more question. Okay. Sorry.
Madam Chair, ever since you said no demagoguery.
I know. Sorry.
Speechless.
I haven't had my cup of coffee yet. I know. Sorry. Unlike our Judiciary Committee, where we all do it all day. I don't know. For some reason, I'm on a short string this morning. Sorry. What I wanted to ask was, you made a really good point, and I didn't remember in Oregon law how this was done, but you said that there are methods by which you can ensure voter fraud doesn't occur. And I didn't understand that. Could you explain that just so I have that on the record?
Okay, for the record, my name is Joanne Schmidt, staff to Senator Elton. The way that they try and maintain security of the ballots is that you have the ballot and you first place it in a secrecy envelope, then you place it in another envelope, and then you sign the outside of the envelope, and that is matched up with the signature on your voter registration form.
Okay. Okay. Well, so are you amenable to talking to the Division of Elections? Okay.
Yes.
And then we'll have the bill back up again and continue the conversation. I do think the 20% number is dismal, and I know it's higher in mine, and as Senator Bundy said, it's higher in his, but I do think it is. And I also think that young people, there is a tremendous sense of our vote doesn't matter, how to participate in the process. We don't feel, and I don't know if this is the answer, but we brought it up to have the conversation continue, but maybe there are some other places for the Division and you and all of us to think about what we can do to meet that goal, because there are just tremendous amounts of young people that aren't voting either. Senator Stevens?
Oh, thank you. And I know this is probably politically incorrect, but I think a lot of people don't vote because they don't feel prepared. They don't know the issues, they don't know the candidates, and they choose not to vote because they're not ready to. And that's a right that we have as Americans to say, I don't know the issues, and I'm not going to vote. You know, so I certainly would like to see more voter turnout, but it has to be informed voter turnout. We just don't want people randomly voting when they have no knowledge of what they're voting on.
The other thing I'd be interested in, if one of you guys can pull this out, so there's this argument that goes back over and over and over again that has repeated itself, that if you increase voter turnout, somehow you have the possibility of bringing in more voters that are Democrats. And I keep hearing, so I just, it's like the 20,000-pound elephant in the room, so I'm just going to say that. And then so that Republicans somehow don't want access to voting. I don't know if that's true. I don't know that statistically that would make a difference. In a state like Alaska, when I make the comments about my fears of families sitting around and being pressured to vote a certain way, I actually think of it more in a Republican context, because the districts of Alaska are primarily Republican dominated. So I, yeah, or independent or nonpartisan, but I kind of think of it from that standpoint. So it'd be interesting to know if there's any information that's ever proven that theory true. In Oregon, maybe that would be a place to look.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, they conducted quite a bit of research on the Oregon project, and they found that Republicans and Democrats favored voting by mail equally, as well as males and females.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Huh. And I would just like to make one more comment, Senator Stevens, through the chair, and to you, Madam Chair. Block voting is certainly a concern, and we certainly wouldn't want any voter to be influenced. But on the flip side, when someone has an opportunity to think about who they're voting for, if they have a ballot that they can hold for a couple of weeks and read the pamphlets about the candidates, they may likely be more informed. Instead of, you know, having to race to the polls at 5:15 after work before they have to get home and cook dinner and decide rather quickly out of a list of 10 names, half of whom they may not even know, who they should vote for. Mm. So I think this is a way for our voters to be more informed.
That's a great point. Okay, one other person to testify that's online, Mitchell Gay from Delta Junction.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
This is Mitchell Gay, and I'm kind of testifying for myself, and we're forming a group called Alaska Liberty and Freedom Movement. So it's kind of half and half because that's not formed yet. But anyway, my biggest concern with this bill and the mail-out vote would be the possibility of voter fraud. And I won't go into that. I think someone else already has. Another problem that I have with the mail-out vote is in Alaska, we have a unique situation in that we have a large military population. We have a large temporary or transient worker population. And a lot of these people register to vote simply to establish residency in Alaska, for various reasons, for hunting and fishing license and for the permanent fund, et cetera, et cetera. With a mail-out vote, I think when you go to the polls, most of these people don't take the time to go to the polls on an election, but in a mail-out vote, it would change that. And even though they're registered voters, they're not permanent Alaska residents, so their voting would not reflect exactly what the permanent Alaska residents might feel. And it could change votes because there's a large number of these people in Alaska. And I just think a mail-out vote would create issues and conflicts for that particular reason. We're in the process now in Delta Junction. Of course, everybody knows about the possibility of a borough, but we're in the process of putting together a petition to submit to change the mail-in vote for the reasons that I previously mentioned and some others. But I would be, and I think most of the people in our area would be totally against the mail-in vote in any form of general election other than absentee voting and such as is already established. And that's pretty much, I didn't have time to prepare a lot this morning, so that's pretty much what I had to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gay. And just one question from me, Liesl, here, is you mentioned that your group was in the process of looking at changes, but that they wouldn't include this. What are some of the changes that you're looking at?
Well, it did include this. We were looking at a petition to actually change the mail-in vote for this borough issue we have here.
Okay.
If comes up, and I don't have the dates written down now, but there's a possibility that the borough issue would be a mail-in vote, which we think would be detrimental to the true vote of the residents here. We're in even more unique situation than part of Alaska in that we have right now almost as many people here temporarily as we do residents. So a mail-in vote, we think, would not be a true reading as to the borough issue here.
Okay, I see. Questions for Mr. Gay? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Anyone else here in the audience wishing to testify on Senate Bill 162? Anyone else online? Okay, any further comments? We'll set the bill aside, and I'd love to work with you and Jason. So, and Senator French, if you've got ideas too. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we'll set Senate Bill 162, the CS, which is /M, to the side. The next bill we have is on judicial retention of election candidates, Senate Bill number 171. And Jason, oh, I see. So we're doing them. We're keeping you in the room all day here. Okay, Senate Bill number 171.
Again, Jason Hooley, Office of Lieutenant Governor, on the record. And Madam Chair, currently there's no provisions in state law that allow judicial candidates to withdraw their name from the general election ballot. And this legislation allows that if the candidate informs the division 48 days prior to that general election. That opportunity is currently available to political candidates and nominating petition candidates. And this bill would allow the same opportunity to the judicial candidates. And historically, the division has ran into this vacancy in state law a couple times, as recently as in the 2006 general election. We were contacted by a candidate who was considering withdrawing their name, and the Department of Law advised us that since we didn't have any explicit statutes that allowed for that, that we would in this case rely on the same standards that are in place for political candidate withdrawal and nominating petition candidate withdrawal. But otherwise, there's nothing we can stand on to allow that, and this bill allows that.
Great. Okay, questions from the committee? Pretty straightforward questions. Okay, hearing and seeing none. Anybody else here in the audience wishing to testify on Senate Bill number 171? Anybody online? Okay, so we have the bill back before us. Is there a motion or?
Madam Chair, I move that Senate Bill 171 out of committee with individual recommendations, and the company zero this one.
Okay, is there any objection to that motion? Okay, hearing and seeing none, Senate Bill number 171 has moved out of the committee. Okay, next we have, thank you, Mr. Hui.
Thank you.
Next we have House Bill number 92, jurisdiction of the ombudsman. Welcome to Senate State Affairs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Ben Mulligan, staff to Representative Bill Stoltz. The representative apologizes for not being here. He has House Finance this morning and also a bill up.
Oh.
To continue, House Bill 92 would remove the Office of Victims' Rights from the jurisdiction of the ombudsman. The sponsors feel, and the reason for this change was that when the Office of Victims' Rights was first formed, it was to act as a sister agency to the ombudsman. It wasn't meant to be underneath it, but to act as the victim's rights ombudsman. And a lot of the provisions of their statutes are based on the ombudsman's statutes. They see a conflict between the ombudsman, who oftentimes helps incarcerated individuals with concerns that they bring forward, and that they may come to the Office of Victims' Rights for information, who is on the other side of the issue helping maybe that person's victim with their issues. And that is the reason for the legislation. There will be also, I believe we have someone from OVR and the ombudsman to testify on this bill if there's any questions.
Yes, and I see that Linda Lord-Jenkins, ombudsman, is online, and Kathy Hansen from OVR. Okay, questions for Mr. Mulligan at this time? No questions? Okay, so let's go to Linda Lord-Jenkins on the line. Linda, are you there?
I am, Madam Chairman. Thank you very much, and thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity to be heard on House Bill 92. HB 92 would remove the Office of Victims' Rights from the jurisdiction of the Alaska Ombudsman, and we respectfully enter our opposition to this bill. If this bill is passed, the legislature would take an action that no legislature has seen fit to take in the 32 years since the Ombudsman was created. I'd first like to state that the Office of the Ombudsman recognizes the importance of the work done by OVR. My opposition to this bill should not be interpreted in any way as minimizing the value of the victim's advocate or the assistance it provides to victims of crimes. We routinely refer complainants to OVR if it appears that OVR is better suited to handle a complainant's issues. I made such a referral within the last 2 weeks and will continue to do so. This issue, this legislation, was raised after a complainant referred by the Ombudsman to OVR returned to the Ombudsman to complain that OVR had not adequately investigated her complaint before declining to act in the complainant's case. The complainant has granted me permission to discuss this case generally, but I will say only that it involves the sexual assault of a mentally handicapped adult by a mentally handicapped adult. The complainant believes that the investigating police agency did not take proper measures to treat the victim with dignity and did not interview the victim in a setting that would have led to the most productive information while at the same time not further traumatizing the victim. The complainant believes that OVR did not adequately review this issue when she contacted the Ombudsman. This is an issue of ensuring that a vulnerable young woman who was horribly victimized is afforded the dignity and respect and assistance to which she is entitled. OVR has taken the position that OVR is a special ombudsman for crime victims. This position is contrary to every public statement of mission and purpose heretofore made by OVR. Since its inception, OVR was considered as an advocate for crime victims, not an impartial investigator. Arguments that being subject to ombudsman oversight would add an unnecessary layer of investigation or result in the ombudsman reversal of a discretionary decision of the victim's advocates reflects a misunderstanding of the work of the ombudsman. It is not the authority or intent of the ombudsman to investigate victim complaints against district attorneys, law enforcement, etc. Instead, investigation of OVR's actions, whether reasonable efforts to investigate victims' complaints are made, whether more weight was given to police officers' perspective than the victim's well-being, whether victims of different backgrounds and abilities are treated equally, whether OVR complies with its own statutes and regulations, etc., is what is contemplated. Thus, it is not an additional layer of investigation of a victim complaint at issue. Other advocacy or investigatory agencies are within the Ombudsman's jurisdiction. Long-term care ombudsman, Adult Protective Services, the Division of Public Assistance Fraud Unit, Human Rights Commission, Alaska Judicial Council, and the Alaska State Troopers all perform investigations. None are excluded from the ombudsman jurisdiction for fear of adding an unnecessary layer of work. Nor in my 19 years with the ombudsman has the ombudsman been accused of unnecessary oversight of these agencies. OVR is not unique in being either an advocate or an investigator. Its functions do not require exemption from the ombudsman's jurisdiction. Nor can it accurately be argued that ombudsman oversight presents a huge burden of labor for OVR. In the years since OVR was created, the ombudsman has received only 2 complaints against the agency. One was closed on our own initiative because of ombudsman review of OVR statutes in light of the Cooper Supreme Court decision. The other remains open and is the subject of this bill, pending the current dispute over ombudsman access to OVR records. Neither is it within the ombudsman's power to contravene a discretionary action taken by a governmental agency, as long as that action is a reasonable and lawful exercise of the agency's discretion and is taken after thorough review of all the facts. If, in the course of an investigation, a reasonable exercise of discretion based on relevant and proper grounds is found, the ombudsman cannot and would not act to reverse such a decision. If, however, investigation reveals arbitrary and capricious exercises of discretion based on improper or irrelevant grounds, then the ombudsman is authorized to recommend alternate courses of actions. We cannot force OVR or any agency to take an action. OVR has refused to discuss the complainant's issue with the ombudsman. If we were to be able to ask questions of OVR, we would ask questions such as these. What issues did OVR staff discuss or develop to review the complaint at hand? what supervision was provided on the investigation. Did OVR staff actually interview the victim? Did OVR staff personally meet the victim? What training does the person who interviewed the victim have in interviewing developmentally disabled individuals? Are any OVR staff trained in interviewing developmentally disabled individuals? Who from the victim's family was interviewed? Who from the police agencies involved did OVR interview, and did those police officers have training in interviewing developmentally disabled individuals? Our concern is that if the ombudsman does not have jurisdiction to investigate complaints against OVR, who does? OVR has represented that complainants can complain to the Alaska Bar Association. However, the bar investigates only ethical lapses, not allegations about the completeness of an investigation. And if there is no ethical component to be investigated, the bar generally advises people to file an action in court. Thus, the victim is forced to go through another loop. Our review of the OVR statutes lead us to believe that OVR's representation that the legislature has authority to investigate complaints against OVR is not entirely correct. All information gathered by OVR is to be held confidential. Alaska Statute 2465.110D requires that no confidential information be released to any person. This includes legislators and their staff. OVR's regulations specifically require written consent from victims before release of information to another. Our review indicates to us that OVR statutes do not allow OVR to speak to legislators about complaints without the victim's consent. The OVR statutes do not permit release of victims' complainants' names without consent. This mandate is reinforced by Alaska Statute 2465.120C, which requires OVR to, quote, maintain confidentiality with respect to all matters and the identities of complainants, close quote. Only to, quote, carry out duties and support recommendations, close quote, can OVR disclose this information. This is the same language used in 23 AAC 30010. Our analysis leads us to believe that legislative oversight would not fall within the narrow exception in Alaska Statute 2465.120 and is arguable only within the exception for release of anonymous statistical information in 23 AAC 3120. Therefore, before the legislature determines that OVR is to be removed from ombudsman jurisdiction, I would urge that you seek a legal opinion from legislative counsel on whether OVR can legally discuss specific case information with legislators and what legal obligation legislators have once they are in receipt of that information in light of OVR's other confidentiality requirements. Mm-hmm. Finally, the question has been raised that the ombudsman has an inherent conflict of interest when investigating OVR complaints because the ombudsman accepts complaints against the Department of Corrections from inmates. It is correct to say that the ombudsman's caseload contains a large number of complaints filed by inmates against the Department of Corrections. Jurisdiction of the ombudsman was established by the legislature, and complaints against the Department of Corrections are included in that enabling legislation. However, I believe it is a misnomer to say that the ombudsman represents inmates to the detriment of others. While the ombudsman accepts such complaints, the ombudsman does not represent or advocate for inmates who complain to the ombudsman. Inmate complaints are handled much as complaints filed by non-incarcerated citizens. My staff reviews the complaint impartially as a neutral, not as an advocate. Our role is to determine if a state agency action is fair and reasonable. The proportion of complaints filed by inmates is large. The ombudsman does not advocate for inmates, but advocates instead for good government. Thus, it is incorrect to characterize our office as an advocate for accused criminals and against victims. Nor can I envision a complaint where we would encounter a conflict between an OVR-represented victim and a person accused of the crime. We have mechanisms in place to prevent such conflict from occurring. Finally, I believe that if crime victims are concerned that the ombudsman's statutory authority to investigate complaints filed by inmates against a state agency presents a conflict, they can vote with their feet and not contact our office. However, I would strongly encourage the legislature to not foreclose crime victims' options to complain to the ombudsman if they are dissatisfied with the work of OVR. Again, I reiterate that I am not in any way minimizing the value of the victim's advocate or the assistance it provides to victims of crime. This is not an issue of one agency being more or less important than the other. This is an issue of ensuring that, in this case, a vulnerable young woman who was horribly victimized is afforded the dignity and respect and assistance to which she is entitled. For this reason, I respectfully enter my opposition to House Bill 92. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Linda. Questions? Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Is it your contention, then, that this bill originates from a single case of complaint?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, that is my contention.
Okay. Thank you.
This was not an issue prior to this complaint being filed with my office.
Senator French.
Thank you. And Ms. Jenkins, good morning. I just have a question about the structure of the bill in front of us. Basically, we have just a long list of definitions.
Yeah.
It's a little hard to kind of figure out what it means. I just opened the statute book, and let me just make sure I understand that your jurisdiction, what the ombudsman does, is set out in 2455-100, and it says the ombudsman has jurisdiction to investigate the administrative acts of agencies. And that's a fairly broad grant of power. And then what we're looking at is a definition of agency to tell us all those things that you have the power to investigate. And it's quite complete. And yet at the very bottom it says you don't investigate the governor, the lieutenant governor, a member of the legislature, and now we're at the justice of the Supreme Court and so forth. And then we're going to add the victim's advocate and the staff of the Office of Victims' Rights. Is that kind of the structure?
Senator French, through the chair, yes, sir.
And so, and just maybe by way of comparison, I was a prosecuting attorney, I was a DA. Had I done something that offended a citizen or a victim or a police officer in my handling of the case, all those individuals would have had the right to come to you to say, hey, someone at an agency made a bad decision. Is that right?
Senator French, through the chair, yes, we have jurisdiction over the Department of Law, and we have had in the past investigated complaints about the actions of district attorneys and the department.
So, in the sponsor statement, where the sponsor statement says the OVR is staffed by attorneys with specialized knowledge, and the ombudsman is not, and this raises the question of institutional competency, when the ombudsman lacks that special legal knowledge necessary to investigate, you're already overseeing lawyers and legal decisions, and you've been doing so for how many years?
Senator French, through the chair, yes, we are, and since the office was formed, was instituted in 75, we've had that statutory jurisdiction.
And one last question, if I as a citizen were unhappy by how the victim's advocate or the staff of the Office of Victims' Rights handled my case, if I went to them as a citizen and they, you know, blew me off, wouldn't return my phone calls, or maybe they handled it my case perfectly, but I'm just a cranky person and like to complain about government. In either case, whether rightly or wrongly treated by the agency, how would I pursue that complaint if this bill were to pass?
Senator French, through the chair, I believe that any citizen has the right to complain to their legislator about the actions of state agencies and legislative agencies in particular, but I truly believe, based on our legal analysis, that OVR would not be able to address a lot of questions. That's one of the concerns that we have, is that there would be no one overseeing OVR as opposed to my office. If a complainant to my office contacts your office to complain about me or my decisions, all they have to do is authorize me to talk to you, and I can talk to you, and I can explain in great detail what we have done and what the basis for our decision is. It is our belief, based on our legal analysis, that the OVR statute does not authorize that sort of disclosure, which is why I've recommended that Ledge Council be asked to take a look at the OVR statute in relationship to what OVR can inform legislators about.
Senator French?
I think he answered two questions, but I only asked one, and I guess I was just really trying to make sure or trying to find out who would handle a complaint about what the victim's advocate and the staff of the Office of Victims' Rights did in their official capacity. Who would handle a complaint about their actions if this bill passed?
Senator French, I don't know. They could go to court, but there are exclusions on what the court can look at for OVR also. They have a lot of discretion at OVR. Perhaps Ms. Hansen can answer that question. I also have one of my staff investigators in the audience, and she is an attorney, and she did some of the legal analysis. Kate Burkhart might be able to answer that better.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator French. And I do see Ms. Burkhart here. She's approaching the podium here.
For the record, I am Kate Burkhart, an assistant ombudsman with the Office of the Ombudsman. Senator French, through the chair, it's our position that if this bill were passed, there would be no oversight of OVR. A person could call you and complain, but the statutes ensuring the confidentiality of the information provided to OVR would preclude OVR from really providing any information to your office. And so effectively, this would render OVR immune from all oversight. And it's the Office of the Ombudsman's position that that is entirely inappropriate. Hmm.
Okay, further, Senator French? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, and then the last person we have is Kathy Hansen from OVR Online. Kathy, tell us your side of the story.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Respectfully, Ms. Lord Jenkins is mistaken about the statutory role and obligations of the Office of Victims' Rights. We have two distinct functions. I train justice agency professionals statewide about our two functions. One is an ombudsman function, another is an advocacy function. In AS 2465 that created our office, there are two sections that track side by side that describe the duties and obligations of the Office of Victims' Rights as an ombudsman and also as an advocate. The portion of our AS 2465 that talks about how we act as a special ombudsman is actually a lot of cut and paste from AS 2455, which is the ombudsman enabling statutes. We litigated a similar issue in the case of Cooper versus District Court, and the Court of Appeals held at some detail that we are the special ombudsman for crime victims in Alaska. So I think if a court was interpreting whether we had that rule, that that's how they would find. We, along with the ombudsman, are the only two satellite offices in the legislative branch of government, and we're tasked to ensure that the government is working properly, and we're in the legislative branch on purpose so that we can report to the legislator and suggest needed change. There is no agency that oversees the ombudsman, Ms. Lord Jenkins' office. They have the final say in their investigations, and if someone doesn't like their decisions, then they complain to their legislator. In the Office of Victims' Rights, that is also to be our role. The legislature recognized the need to have an office with legal expertise, and all of our staff are attorneys with prosecution experience, in order to effectively evaluate cases and whether or not the investigations were handled properly and the prosecutions were handled properly. If HB 92 were not passed, you would have an ombudsman investigating an ombudsman. And it's our position that that would be an unnecessary layer of oversight and waste the resources of the legislature. Both of our agencies report to the legislature, and most of the complaints we've had from crime victims about the services, rather than going to the ombudsman, they have gone directly to the legislature, and we have worked with the legislature on ensuring that the cases were handled properly. If there's a question statutorily about whether the Office of Victims' Rights has the legal authority under AS 2465 to do that, then and it were found that we didn't have the authority to do that, then that would be the statutory change that would be needed, not to have the ombudsman give us oversight. The main concern that there are a lot of concerns, but Office of Victims' Rights is concerned that if HB 92 is not passed, what we'll end up with is disparate outcomes. Victims might go to the ombudsman for help, or they might go to the Office of Victims' Rights for help, and they might get different findings. And the ombudsman's findings might not be based on a complete understanding of the workings of the criminal justice system. In AS 2465, the legislature intended to have an Office of Victims' Rights director who makes the final discretionary decision on cases that come before him or her, and even went so far in Section 180 as to make it clear that even Superior Court judges cannot review the discretionary decisions of the Office of Victims' Rights. All they can do is look at AS 2465 and hear complaints that OVR is not following its own statutory law. The Ombudsman's statutes were created in 75, and Office of Victims' Rights were created in 2001. And basically what's happened is it wasn't made clear that Ombudsman should not be looking at Office of Victims' Rights as one of the agencies it oversees. It was intended that way. It was drafted that way. And it needs to be made clear. There are provisions in AS 2465 that exempt us from subpoena or discovery of privileged information. That's AS 2465-200. And even the Ombudsman statutes say that they, except for privileged information, they have subpoena power. So if they send us a subpoena, but it has to do with privileged information, under their statutes, they're not able to get the information. And under our statutes, we are statutorily prohibited from providing any information from our files in response to subpoena or discovery request. So the simple fix is to pass HB 92. The alternative, if you decide that you want Ombudsman to have oversight over Office of Victims' Rights, you'd have to substantially restructure AS 2455. To put it in sync with that intent. There are some examples of things that Office of Victims' Rights can do for crime victims that Ombudsman or their current statutes cannot. They cannot access clemency files from the governor's office. Office of Victims' Rights can and has. Office of Victims' Rights can look at state court judges' confidential documents from court files. Ombudsman cannot. And that's specifically outlined in their statute. They cannot oversee Superior Court judges. Ombudsman in their statute specifically cannot look at ongoing criminal investigations. Office of Victims' Rights can. A percentage of our caseload is people who are concerned because they make a complaint to the police and they don't feel that this response was adequate. Either the investigation takes too long or the prosecution is taking too long to screen it, or they have declined it, and that is the kind of thing that we're looking at. It's important for the committee to understand that there are cold cases that are stalled. They don't close. They always remain active until solved. And so when we're looking at a case like the case that Ms. Lord Jenkins is wanting information from, it's an active criminal investigation until enough information is gathered to prosecute. And that may never happen, but as long as it's in that pre-charging stage, that's something we can look at when the Ombudsman statutes don't permit that. So we're really just trying to clean up the language in both sets of statutes by making this simple fix.
Ms. Hansen?
Yes.
I think that the root of it, what I'm trying to understand, though, is, and I appreciate both you and Linda's testimony because you've laid it out very clearly, you know, where the potential problems are. My concern at the heart of it is this individual. And my fear is that if we were to pass this bill, we might cut off this individual's process that she's going through. And I don't cast aspersions either way. I truthfully don't know enough information to know what happened. But there is some merit in the fact that while there may have been ambiguity, at least this individual felt she had rights and asserted them and is in a process right now. And I guess my fear is that if we were to pass this bill, we just quash those rights. we just quash that process. And I don't know what message, again, you're the speaking on behalf of victims and the Office of Victims' Rights, and that's always my concern, is the victim. And so would this individual feel re-victimized all over again? You know, the heavy hand of the legislature reaching in to sort of quash her rights. And I just wondered what your thoughts were.
Thank you. That's a very important concern, and I agree. And what I've testified for other committees is to tell you that we already have in place greater protections for crime victims at the OVR than for people who are receiving services from the Ombudsman. Because we're an office of bar-certified attorneys, we have to follow additional ethical violations under the Alaska Bar Association. And if we have a case and we just don't investigate it, or we don't provide minimal competence to our client, then the client can go to the Bar Association and give it a second look. That's one option. The second option is to go to their legislator and say, look, the Office of Victims' Rights isn't doing its job. I really have to tell you that what's going on with this case is not that the case wasn't investigated. It's just the opinion about the depth of investigation that was needed, and that was a discretionary decision. And it's important that ombudsmen, I mean, I understand they want to help, but what really needs to happen is you got to have one ombudsman.
Yeah, and I see your position. Well, at this stage, we're going to go ahead and set the bill aside and get some more information. Both Linda and Kathy, thank you for your testimony. I think it's safe to say there's a lot of discussion going on in the building about what the right decision is. And I don't disagree that there is some potential ambiguity. And then we've got a victim issue here. And so we've got to sort through it and figure out what the right answer is. But I appreciate your testimony today and your time. And with that, we're adjourned.